looking for fun and feeling groovy. Looking for fun and feeling groovy.
Good morning, Reading. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to our show, Positively Healthy, here on KCNR 1460. Another beautiful day in the North State. Reminding you that all of these shows on KCNR can be heard on the computer. You can have anyone listen anywhere, and you can go back and listen to old shows. And so I've had a chiropractic and nutrition practice for 19 years here in Reading. And, you know, we've worked on trying to help people rebuild their immune systems and get their health back. And for all those people trying to make a little shift for if they don't feel good or feel vital, we've been working really hard. My producer's eating a jelly donut and smiling.
I love jelly donuts.
Working really hard to help people eat real food, food that they can identify, food that does not have hydrogenated fat, food that doesn't have refined sugar. And so, you know, there are always going to be people who are going to live to be 95 and they're going to smoke 10 packs of cigarettes a day, and they'll be able to eat whatever foods they want, and they can drink and they cannot exercise. And, you know, that's great. That's wonderful. And then there are those folks that are feeling lousy today, and that they know they need to do something, and they're not quite sure what to do to feel a little better. And this show is for you. And so this show offers a lot of ideas to start making tiny little changes to get a little bit healthier. And so what I want for you is for you to feel vital and to be interesting to yourself and to have a full life. And so with that, I want to get on with what we're up to today. You know, back in the 70s, we did a lot of kind of crazy fun cooking, and the more I've talked to people throughout the years, I guess it wasn't everybody who was doing all that cooking. You know, I understand that there were a lot of people who were just maybe eating very, you know, more convenience foods, processed foods. And in the studio today, I have my sister Tori, and welcome.
Good morning. So nice to be here.
Thanks. I'm glad you're here. And so we're going to talk a little bit about 70s cooking, and on the line, not quite yet, we're not going to go to her yet, we have cookbook author Susan Hilliard of the Deaf Smith Country Cookbook, which came out in the 70s, 1973. And so we're going to go through and kind of just reminisce a little at first and talk about the history of what, you know, how did people used to eat? What would motivate someone to work that hard to put together a natural foods cookbook? And then I want to remind you that next week we have Carrie Ann Gein on. And so she is our GMO expert in our town. And so, you know, genetically modified organisms are something where right now you might even not have a clue what I just said. And they're these frustrating new concept that unless you're eating organic, you're probably exposed to them and you need to know more. So I'll be really depressed next week when we have that show, because it's just, I don't know, like if there isn't enough to worry about. Okay, so I want to bring Susan on, so let's go ahead and Susan, are you with us? Let's see if we have Susan on line one. Susan, are you with us?
Yes.
Oh, good. Well, welcome to the show, and thanks for taking the time to come on and dedicate a little time to us today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you know, part of looking through the cookbook again and looking at different recipes, it was definitely a journey for us. And one of the things I was probably most impressed with at the beginning was just the preface of the book and sort of the inspiration. And I wanted to include the readers or the listeners a little bit into some of the information that, I'm trying to get a little light in here. Okay, so let's see. It says, it is our natural birthright, the opportunity to eat real pure food, drink pure water, and breathe pure air in a world where we are in harmony with nature. And then in the preface of your cookbook that you wrote with a group of folks, it says that most important, it will be an adventure for you and your family, you know, speaking to the person who owns the cookbook, to gain more self-reliance, individual responsibility, and a happier relationship with your immediate surroundings. And so as you discover the joys of good basic cooking, you will probably become interested in starting an organic garden in the corner of your yard, sprouting beans and seeds that can be raised, in quotes, right on your kitchen counter, you know, on your windowsill. And perhaps even herbs from your garden. These are family projects, and they draw the family of humankind closer together, and that's what this book is all about. And that's from the preface of your book. And when we come back from our break right now, I want to get into what prompted you and your team to write this cookbook. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You're listening to Positively Healthy, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to Positively Healthy here on KCNR 1460. And we're talking to cookbook author Susan Hilliard of the Deaf Smith Country Cookbook from 1973. And Susan, so what was going on at the time that you decided that, you know, how did this whole cookbook come about?
Well, it's an interesting story. My husband, Roger, was working for Arrowhead Mills at the time. And it was just the beginning of the whole natural foods movement. So the New York Times came out and did an article on the mill. And when this article came out in the New York Times, we had like three publishers called up and said, was there anyone there who could write a cookbook? And several of us had always been interested in natural foods and concerns for the environment and eating healthy. And we said, sure, we can do a cookbook. And so we went with Macmillan and they published it.
Oh, that's great. Now, what were other people eating? What brought a need for a natural foods cookbook?
People, they were generally eating the sort of standard American diet at the time, meat, potatoes, Jell-O, sugar, a lot of dairy products. And we felt like people were going to be healthier if they ate more naturally. It was better for the environment. And the book was really aimed at encouraging people to move into natural foods who hadn't really done it before. So we're trying to ease them in slowly and teach them some of the basics.
Like what? What kind of basics?
Well, how to substitute for refined products more natural. Like if you were using white flour, like how would it compare to, you know, how do you replace it with whole wheat flour? Or if you were using like sour cream, it was better for you to use yogurt, and replacing sugar with other sweeteners like honey and some of those types. What else? You know, better oils and eating more beans, like brown rice instead of white rice.
And then what was the response when this cookbook came out? I mean, was this something where people thought, this is nuts, why would we want to do that, or was it embraced?
Well, I'm sure there were some people who thought it was nuts, but pretty much it was, it was very successful. It was really good timing because it was the beginning of the whole movement. So it was one of Macmillan's, I think, best sellers. It sold over 400,000 copies.
That's great. And then, you know, when we look back in time, you know, I looked up when Bisquick came about, you know, this morning, and it arrived in 1931, and here we're talking about white refined flour, hydrogenated oil, sugar, kind of all packaged together as, you know, for Bisquick, biscuits quick. I mean, that's what it was about. And my hunch would be that there would have been other sort of whole foods movements maybe in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. Do you know if there were other movements along the way? Or
there were some, like Adele Davis, but it hadn't really caught on. I mean, there was definitely people interested. Rodale Foods was around. So there was interest, but I think it wasn't until you know, the middle to late 60s that it really started catching on.
And then, go ahead.
I think most of the people before that were considered sort of, they were like health food nuts, eccentric, and it just didn't, it wasn't what was happening. I mean, I grew up on the typical American diet, meat and potatoes.
And where were you raised?
In New York.
In
Chicago, New York.
Okay. And so then you were already having a Whole Foods awakening before your husband started working at Arrowhead Mills in Texas, which was all about organic whole grains, or you were, or it kind of all happened at the same time, or?
Well, even when we were living in the Haight-Ashbury, the whole macrobiotic movement was starting, and we, that's where we started. And so then we moved to New Mexico because things got kind of weird in the Haight, and we continued eating macrobiotically and eventually went to Boston to study with the Cushies. But when we then we ended up in a school bus, we traveled around the country. And
I love it.
I mean, we did the whole thing. Roger was still working for Erewhon when we had the school bus, which was a big natural foods company. And so we were going around meeting with farmers, and he was contracting for crops for Erewhon, and we were going to all the natural food stores. So, and we had two kids then, and so we had this big school bus. It was fabulous. And then Roger was offered a job at Arrowhead Mills to help market and promote the company, and so then we ended up in Texas. And it was a lot harder to get macrobiotic food in Texas, so we sort of broadened our diet a little, but we still, you know, were eating natural foods.
Now, what was happening in Texas at that time? I mean, I called Hereford, Texas, just to see how big it was last week, and it has 15,000 people now.
Uh-huh.
So it was a tiny place.
There are a lot of feedlots in Hereford. A lot.
Yeah.
At the time, there were probably 15 to 20 employees at the mill. It was pretty small, but the soil there is really outstanding, and that's why they were growing, you know, wheat and corn there. So most of Texas didn't know what we were about.
I can see that. Hey, it's time for us to take a break. That happens on radio, so Susan, don't go anywhere. And okay. When we come back from this break, we'll get back to you. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You're listening to Positively Healthy here on KCNR. We'll be right back.
What do you...
Kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and fear.
Oh, welcome back. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to Positively Healthy here on KCNR. And our guest today is Susan Hilliard, one of the authors of the Death Smith Country Cookbook from 1973. And this is one of the probably five instrumental cookbooks of my life. We definitely got derailed, I would say, for a good 10-year period, really cooking a lot of whole foods. My sister Tori is here in the studio today, and we're talking with Susan, and we're learning the history, Susan's history of how you end up part of a food movement in the 70s. And Susan, can you let us include us in the enlighten us, I should say, to the other authors of your cookbook?
Well, Margie Ford was Frank Ford's wife, and we were friends. Frank owned Arrowhead Mills, and so we both lived in Hereford, and so we volunteered to do the cookbook. And then Mary Falk Cook was a pretty well-known cookbook writer before that of Texas-style Texas cookbooks. So we recruited her to join us, and she kind of did a lot of the marketing. She went on like the Today Show, and she was used to doing that. Margie and I could never have done that. But so that helped, you know, with the sales of the cookbook, and that was really her role.
And then, so who did all of the practicing of recipes? I would have to think that there's just a whole lot of kitchen time where you're thinking, should that be a half of a cup or a quarter of a cup? Or did you do a lot of collecting recipes from people you knew? I mean, I see as you're thanking people at the beginning of the book, there are a whole lot of names there. I mean, how much work was that to put that together?
We did solicit recipes from everyone we knew, including the macrobiotic community and anyone we could think of. And we got a lot of recipes. Of course, we couldn't use them all, but we did have to test every recipe, and it took about a year of testing.
Go ahead.
It's sort of not my style to measure things so precisely, so it was a
good
experience for me. So, you know, you throw this and that in, but you can't do that with a cookbook.
You're right. However, I would have loved that cookbook. And so now, I want to go through what your favorite recipes were. I know that, you know, you actually have your name on one recipe, which was a carob cake recipe. And so you were telling me that was one of your favorite recipes. Now, explain that one for people.
Well, when I was raising my children, I have three children, I was trying to give them mostly natural foods. And so I was trying to find substitutes. They'd have parties, and none of their friends knew any of this. So I'd try and have things that seemed like they were, you know, the real thing, but were really healthy. And it didn't always go over very well. But so I would make that for their birthday parties, and sometimes kids liked it, and they really didn't like the carrot cake I made.
Now, why is that? Is it just the texture of carrot cake that when kids are too young, they don't like it, you think?
I think they were so used to, like, white flour cakes.
Oh, okay.
Different was just like, my kids weren't, but, you know, they ate it, but
oh, okay.
They didn't know anything different.
Ah, very good. Way to keep them sheltered.
Right.
Well, you know.
It didn't last so long.
No, I know. We loved carob, but carob got such a bad rap, I think, because it was sold as a chocolate substitute. And I think that if it could have just been, you know, left to its own accord, I think it would have been quite popular. You know, I mean, I've had carob in my cupboard for the last 25 years. I consider it a staple. And then I don't really cook with it that much. I've probably had the same carob for 25 years. but it's just that letdown factor. When people see something dark and brown, they think chocolate. And so it's that, you know, it's our conditioning. So what do you think, Tori?
Well, it is your conditioning, but if you're, I think, the better foods you eat, the more refined your taste is, or discriminating your taste is, and I just wanted to share. Hello, Susan.
This is my being here,
first of all.
Yeah.
But, so, cookbooks like yours were certainly influential in my life and my sister's life, and for better or for worse, the people in our immediate family who have got to try all these things that we created. But recently on a trip, a road trip. We pulled over. I was really kind of needing some. Well, I was needing some carob malt balls specifically, and so we had hunted down. You know, you plugged in all our intuitive powers and found a natural health food store. It only had chocolate, and it was like the only disappointing thing on the entire trip is that there was no carob. So, you know, your influences and making those shifts really start to become a way of life and desirable as well.
Yeah, I think it has its own unique flavor, and that I would definitely prefer it to chocolate any day. And I don't know, throughout my entire life, I'm not really a chocolate person. I just think carob is much more fascinating. So thank you. And you know, as the show goes on here, I want us to give out the carob cake recipe to those who are adventurous and would like to try it. Now, you have other recipes that you made a lot, you know, early on, Susan, and then you have some recipes that you just still keep making. They're just part of you. And so I wanted to hear the recipes that you made a lot, kind of maybe burned yourself out. And what were those recipes?
One recipe I really like, and I still make, is the toasted oatmeal recipe. And I had a friend come visit, and he said, I said, I'll make you some oatmeal. He says, no, I hate oatmeal. I've never liked oatmeal. My mother always tried to give me oatmeal. So I made him this toasted oatmeal, and he goes, oh, this doesn't taste like oatmeal. This is really good.
Oh, my gosh.
So people who don't like oatmeal can try that.
And what is it? Take the listeners through what toasted oatmeal is.
Well, you know, you use oat flakes and you toast them, which gives them kind of a nutty flavor, and then you add boiling water and cook them, oh, I don't know, till the just 30 minutes. You don't have to cook them that long in the book. And then you put in a little salt and some soy sauce. I put soy sauce on almost everything. And it just gives them a totally different flavor.
So we're not talking about a sweet type oatmeal. We're talking about one with soy sauce on it.
Right. And my kids still put soy sauce on their cereal, and like their wives are like, ew. They still do it. So I made some impression.
I guess so. Okay, so then it's more of a savory food than a sweet mm-hmm. food.
Right.
Okay, guess what? I have not made that before. That'll be happening tomorrow morning at my house. Hey, it's time for us to take a radio break, and so don't go anywhere, Susan, and we'll be back after this set of messages. You're listening to Positively Healthy. Back. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to Positively Healthy, and we're talking to cookbook author Susan Hilliard, and she was a co-author of the Death Smith Country Cookbook, which was one of those really groovy 70s cookbooks. And, you know, we're on memory lane here, and my sister Tori is in the studio with us, and we're loving this. We're talking about 70s food and some really important changes in the American diet that happened because of the 70s, and then we started talking a little bit about the excesses during the break, and there were things that we just all ate too much of, and we went overboard, and we got weird a little bit. I don't know about you, Susan, but we got, you know, we started having these foods, like a lot of them. I mean, I remember that we would put alfalfa sprouts on just about anything, and you know, sunflower seeds were a mainstay, and we put brewer's yeast on a lot of stuff. And I know my sister made some odd concoctions that she probably ate for 15 years of yogurt, homemade yogurt, which we made our own yogurt, and on the yogurt would be just a whole bunch of kind of granola, sunflower seeds. What's that stuff that you lived on that? What was in that?
Oh, I think I spent the late 70s in this yellow ochre cloud of brewer's yeast. I put it on absolutely everything.
Yeah.
In it, or paste, or, you know, you could use it kind of like a paste.
We put it on popcorn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I remember that you would make kind of these, well, you also would eat at the yogurt shop. And
we had kind of yogurt took hold here, I think, in the late 70s, early 80s, and I can't remember if they actually offered this, or perhaps it's something that we assisted them with. But we go get, you know, that frozen yogurt. It kind of has stayed kind of a cultural mainstay now, but it was new at the time, and put some brewer's yeast, wheat germ, sunflower seeds, and sprouts. They had to have sprouts.
Oh,
I think that maybe that was their idea.
I hope
come
so.
Come to think of it.
Wouldn't that be nice if
sprouted
it wasn't
yogurt bowl or something like that it was called. So, yeah, I kind of let that one go.
Okay, good.
Yeah, done with that.
Oh, you're done with that?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Susan, what about you? What did you guys just eat a little too much of in the 70s?
Well, carrot juice was a big thing. And if you add too much carrot juice, you started turning orange.
And we know that.
So that my early experiences.
Oh, dear.
Oh, that's not a tan?
That's not a tan? Oh. Yeah, and what else did you guys kind of overdo?
Well, when we were first getting into macrobiotics, we used to, like, eat brown rice for 10 days, nothing else. That was supposed to be a cleansing thing, which I guess it was, but you really got tired of brown rice. But
oh, that's great. Oh, I love it. Hey, we have another guest host here in the studio. Mark Beecham is here. And, Mark, you wanted to ask some questions?
Yeah, I have a question. What happens to you if you eat brown rice for 10 straight days?
You get thinner.
Really?
But also, like, it's supposed to purify, you know. I think if you eat 10 days of anything, like a one product, it sort of purifies your body. And with the brown rice, it's supposed to put you in balance, sort of it's a sodium-potassium balance. And then macrobiotically, you kind of start adding things that are close to the center and balancing yin and yang, and that's how you're supposed to maintain your balance through macrobiotics.
About your cookbook, how was it received? Was it a bestseller, or was it just a good seller? What kind of reviews and what kind of reception did you get from the cookbook buying public?
It sold really well. It was like perfect timing because everybody was just getting interested in, and it was geared to the general public who were starting to use natural foods. So, it was one of Macmillan's bestsellers. It sold over 400,000 copies.
Okay, and so as we go through the cookbook here, I wanted to just take the time, because I know the listeners, part of this show is people love recipes, and I think that your carob cake recipe seems like it's something that pretty much, you know, sounds kind of doable. Do you want me to read that recipe, or do you have that in your head or in front of you, Susan?
Why don't you read it?
Okay, so Susan has this recipe here. It's called Susan's Birthday Cake, and it's a carob cake. And if you haven't cooked with carob, you know, carob is a pod, and you can buy it at the health food store. It just comes in a powder. And so it says here that you have 1.5 cups of butter softened, okay, 1.5 cups of raw honey, 6 eggs, 3 cups of whole wheat pastry flour, 1/2 cup of carob powder, 1 teaspoon baking powder, and it says low sodium, 1/4 teaspoon sea salt, 1 cup of milk, and 1 teaspoon of vanilla. And then the actual directions are that you're going to cream together butter and honey. Okay, just whip that up, and then add in your eggs 1 at a time, beating well after each addition. Stir in the flour and the carob powder and the baking powder and the salt all together. Mix that up. And then you're going to add, alternating with milk and the egg mixture, and then you're going to add the vanilla. And so you've got basically, you know, batter right now. And then you're going to pour that into a well-greased and floured angel food cake pan or into 2 loaf pans. And then, you know, it says bake from 1.25 to 1.5 hours at 325, but to not overcook. I imagine that turns into a brick if you overcook that, based on my experience. Okay, turn out on a rack to cool, and then you would add some maple icing, and it sounds like you have kind of a favorite icing that you've always used.
I did then. I mean, I don't do a whole lot of baking these days.
Yeah. I know a lot of us eat a lot fewer carbs these days, but we were into it then. But this just looks like a great birthday cake, a special occasion cake, you know. And so when we come back, we'll read the frosting. And so and then what would your comments be for the listener who is probably going to email me and try to get a little clearer on that recipe? What would you suggest for people?
You know, I would keep a close eye on the time.
Yeah.
Because that can vary a lot. And also, you know, you can still buy this cookbook on Amazon for almost nothing.
That's great. Good. I do know that. I do know that. Yes. And so really just watch the time and then explain the consistency to them. What type of a cake is this? Is this like a heavy pound cake that's kind of brownish in color and has that nice carob flavor?
Yeah, it would be more like a pound cake.
Okay. Well, good. Well, it's time for us to take a break here. And don't go anywhere, Susan. And this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and we'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back. Hey, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to our show, Positively Healthy. We're talking with cookbook author Susan Hilliard of the Deaf Smith Country Cookbook from 1973, and we have her on the show today. My sister is a co-host, Tori Pratt, and we're reminiscing a little bit, and we're remembering the 70s food movement. And in a way, we're thanking the 70s food movement and honoring it. And, you know, a lot of things that are similar are happening again, and we sort of keep recycling some of these same recipes and same philosophies. And the more we try to eat local food and support our local our local farmers and ranchers, and the more we can invest in them, the more they can invest in us, and this nice little cycle happens. And so when we look through the cookbook, you know, I can't help but take you on a journey. And I probably 5 cookbooks were informative, really kind of shaping the way I thought about food. And, you know, the ideas, simple concepts that had to do with whole grains, getting away from bleached white flour and having whole grains was just such a 70s thing for me. We learned how to make yogurt. You know, we got our first yogurt maker from that blue chip stamp store. You know, it's, I don't know, that was the 70s, all right. On our kitchen windowsill, we had alfalfa sprouts sprouting, and a lot of people did. We got away from boxed cereals, and we made homemade granola. And we didn't do a whole lot of sprouting nuts and grains until later, but, you know, part of Susan's cookbook recommends sprouting. We had sunflower seeds on almost everything. I couldn't even eat them for 20 years. I just, you know, enough was enough. And finally, they're back in my diet, and I still have a little bit of a love-hate relationship with them. Also in 70s cooking, we grated cheese on just about everything. If there, you know, we had gardens, and if we were to make a casserole, and in these cookbooks, I have several cookbooks here, including Susan's Deaf Smith Country Cookbook, there's a lot of 1 cup of cheese or 2 cups of grated cheese or on top of things. And some of these cookbooks really got us eating brewer's yeast. You know, it's so high in B vitamins and good for you and very hard to digest. And so there were a lot of foods that they just became our landscape, the way we were raised. And, you know, on my head today I have this goofy headband because it's what I would wear when we cooked, and it's something I made, this patchwork quilt thing. And I couldn't find my clogs. I think I threw them out. And I have on sort of this gauze shirt, kind of this, I don't know what type of shirt it is. It's a 70s shirt. And we did a lot of cooking, you know. We were raised on a hill in Old Shasta without a television, and we had cookbooks, and we were big followers of Adele Davis and Gaylord Houser, and just sort of the beginning of for our generation of eating real foods. And our friends ate a lot of white flour, white sugar, and like all things, you know, in our family, we went overboard. You know, whether we were crocheting, we didn't just make a potholder, we made like 500, you know, and we made granny patch vests. We had one for everybody in our class. And we just sort of went for it. And so part of the personality is to make a shift and a change. And Susan, when you look at your cookbook, I mean, you must look back at this thing as something that changed the future. Do you see that?
Oh, I think it made a huge difference. People really liked it. And I think it did get a lot of people into natural foods who might not have known how to do it. So I think it had a big impact.
Do you get calls from people or emails or letters from people out of the blue 20 years on thanking you or mentioning that they've run across your book for the first time and how it may have changed their life or their kids' lives?
Not anymore. We used to, but this was 73, so now it's been getting on 40 years.
Hey, watch it. That ages us.
Well, what about me? So, not anymore. But I did do a search online, and people were still talking about it. I'm like, good grief. They're still using this cookbook.
I know.
So that was kind of nice.
That is great. In fact, you know, there were a lot of old Arrowhead Mills foods I saw people looking for online, and they were remembering the Deaf Smith peanut butter, and, you know, that they couldn't find that magical peanut butter anymore. And then there were people looking for your cookbook, and they were remembering things. And, you know, it was sort of a fun trip down memory lane, and then people were remembering 70s food. And so, you know, I haven't really tried to put in a category something called 70s food for a really long time. And so...
Well, if you were going to describe 70s food, how would you describe it?
As far as what people in general are eating or what the natural foods movement?
Natural foods movement.
A lot of grains, wheat, brown rice, vegetables, not so different from what people are eating now. It's like still a growing movement, it seems like. So I don't think it's so different.
Has the natural foods movement, did you notice a change in the fare that restaurants would be offering? And if so, when did you start seeing that change?
I lived in Santa Cruz for a long time, so it's, you know, Santa Cruz is a little
very different. Very different.
Than the rest of the country. So here, it's kind of been probably ever since. You know, you can always find vegetarian things, and almost all restaurants, you know, are more conscious now, particularly of organic vegetables. And I don't know. It took a while for the restaurants to really get into it, I think.
Do you think it's because it was too unpopular, or do you think because it was cumbersome to make, or, you know, I mean, everybody's looking for convenience, especially a restaurant.
Right. I don't know. It can be more expensive was one issue.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think once the demand was there, then they came along.
Okay. Well, it's time for us to go to a radio break, and when we come back, I want to give the frosting recipe, so I need to find that in your cookbook while we're on break. And then when we come back, after we give the frosting recipe, I want to switch over to some of your new passions and some of the things you've been doing since then. And then I also want to see what recipes you still are making today, because that's just really fun to hear, too. So this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You're listening to Positively Healthy, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. Hey, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to Positively Healthy, and we're talking to cookbook author Susan Hilliard. Susan, welcome back.
Thank you.
Hey, before I give the recipe for maple icing that I'm still kind of looking for here, I wanted to hear what foods have really held for you. What are you still eating? And if you're not eating things out of your cookbook, what are you eating? What's life like for you now?
I still eat brown rice. Never give that up. I do have a vegetable garden in the front yard, so I grow a lot of vegetables that I cook. So it's mostly miso soup, which I still make, grains, vegetables, not a lot of sweets, and not a lot of dairy. I eat yogurt, but not much. I don't drink milk. That's kind of it.
So you've simplified.
I do eat a little chocolate.
Yeah, that's cute. Good for you.
So and I would say, yeah, if you're making the carob cake, I would use pastry flour, whole wheat pastry flour, and not regular whole wheat flour.
Okay, make it just a little bit lighter.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see here. Okay, maple icing or carob icing? Which one would you suggest?
Well, carob, I guess you could do either, but probably maple icing.
Maple? Okay. It's very short. Okay, listeners, here's your maple icing. 1.5 cups pure maple syrup, 4 egg whites, and 1/4 teaspoon of sea salt. Now, that looks like it's technique dependent there, Susan. You want to take the listeners through that?
With the instructions?
Yeah, okay. Bring the maple syrup to a boil in a heavy saucepan. Okay. Continue to cook at a low boil until the syrup spins a fine thread when dripped from a spoon or to a soft ball stage. Okay, we're over my head. We're past my skill level.
Sugars will do that.
Okay.
And then the egg whites are, I'll just go on it. Have the egg whites and salt in a bowl of electric mixer. Turn the mixer on high speed. Pour the hot maple syrup in a fine stream into the egg whites and beat until the mixture is thick and stiff but still soft. And then spread uncooled Susan's birthday cake.
My birthday is this coming Thursday. I just would like to interject that.
I think maybe we know.
At this moment.
We know what your cake is going to be there, sister. Okay, now that's an interesting technique. So that's something where you have egg whites and you're thickening the syrup by heating it. And so you have something that's going to look like frosting with two sort of healthy ingredients. I love this. Okay, we can do that. Any little tips for folks? on that?
If you don't, well, no, but if you don't want to go to that extreme, the carob frosting is easier to make.
I can see that. at first reading, I thought, oh, the ingredients are short on this one, but we have to try it. It sounds too interesting. I've never done that before. So, yeah.
Well, good luck.
Yeah, you'll be getting an email from me, 15 questions while I'm making her a birthday cake. So, hey, let's move on then to what, you know, you have passions as a photographer. You took the pictures in the cookbook, and you have a life of being a professional photographer, and you have a new book out now. So update our listeners to what you're up to now.
I'll tell you quickly the funny story about the photos in the cookbook.
Okay.
They were done for another book. Frank Ford was doing a book of poetry, and so the photos were for the poetry book, and then Macmillan decided not to publish the poetry book, and so they took the photos and put them in the cookbook.
Well, you know what's funny is I called the Chamber of Commerce last week out in Texas, and I said, what does it look like there? And they said, it's flat. And I said, so, you know, because you have pictures in here of, like, a conifer forest, you know, like pine trees.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's what it looks like in this part of Texas? I'm moving there. And so I'm having them, you know, tell me what it looks like in Texas. And they said, no, it's basically like prairie. And so I said, okay. And so I thought I would try to, if I would remember, I would ask you about the pictures in the cookbook because they didn't really seem to match. They're beautiful, though.
Yeah, they were taken in all over. I mean, some were taken there, but they were just pictures for the poetry book, so they didn't really relate to the book.
Yeah, well, they're very nice. Okay, so tell us what you're doing now. We've got about 2 minutes or 3 minutes left.
Okay. Now I'm doing a lot of nature photography, birds and wild horses, and I just started doing the horses last year in New Mexico, and I mean, they're wonderful, to see the wild horses, and unfortunately they're being rounded up all the time, and it's very sad. But I do have a book that people can order, and you can see it through my links through my website, which is SusanHilliard.com. But it's tragic what's happening.
Well, tell our listeners what's happening so they can know a little more about it.
The BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, is rounding up all these wild horses because they're saying that the land can't justify it, but the real reason is so the cattle ranchers can use the land for their cattle. And so the horses are being rounded up, and they're being adopted and sent to other places. And horses have these social bands of families, and they get split up. It's heartbreaking, really.
Now, you were saying that a lot of the horses, the BLM horses that aren't adopted, they just sort of go out in these holding pens, and they pretty much just live their life in a tiny little, you know, corral somewhere.
Yeah.
Now, where is that, and how many horses are there?
I don't know. They're different areas of the country. I mean, they're rounding up 2,000 horses outside Susanville, which is just insane. And they do it with these helicopters, and it terrifies the horses. It's just awful. There is a website called wildhorsepreservation.org that gives more information about it.
Now,
you can contact your representatives in Washington and tell them what you think, because they need to hear it.
Is there any reason why herd control couldn't happen without relocating horses? I mean, can you send the herd by, I don't know, castrating a certain percentage of those that are less optimal?
They do have, they don't castrate them, but they have, there's such something that they're using to make them infertile and I think they have to do it every year. So that's how, like in Wyoming at the Pryor Mountain wild horses, they shoot them with darts, and it doesn't really hurt them. And so then they're not producing, and that's how they're controlling the herd there, which could be done all over.
Wow. Well, that concludes our show today. And Susan, I want to thank you for coming on and teaching us a lot about the history of the 70s movement and natural foods and all your efforts over these years. I absolutely appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Sure. And this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You've been listening to Positively Healthy. Have a great day.